and you may begin whenever you're ready.
May it please the court, I'm Catherine Lawler, and it's my pleasure to represent the appellant, George Watson Scott. The critical component that was missing in this case was the requisite element of malice, which, of course, is what distinguishes murder from manslaughter. Implied malice, as it relates to Virginia Code Section 18.2-32, essentially has two prongs to it. First, there must be an act which is either wrongful, intentional, or cruel. The second component is that that act must be committed by one person against another. The case law frequently says to another or by one person against another. This statement of law is reflected both throughout Virginia case law as well as in the Virginia model jury instruction, and that would be instruction 33.220. In this case, the first prong was established. You have an intentional act. However, the second prong was directly and conclusively negated both by the evidence at trial and the trial court's specific finding of fact. The evidence at trial consisted of four eyewitnesses to the event. The shooter and the decedent were located nearly 400 feet apart, and we had two eyewitnesses that were located near the shooter and two eyewitnesses that were located near the decedent. So as far as a murder trial, there is pretty good eyewitness coverage at trial. The two witnesses that were located near the shooter were 20 to 25 feet behind the shooter. So they are not in the direction of the shooting. It's occurring in the opposite direction. Neither of them observed anyone else in the area at the time of the shooting.
Well, counsel, that's not quite correct. Mr. Moore, who's in the car while his wife is taking out groceries, sees two individuals walking with their bikes up the street. Isn't that fair to say?
Correct, Your Honor, and that's before the shooting.
That's before the shooting. And intent is something that is a factual determination. Is that fair to say as well?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So why would it be an improper inference from the facts that a moment before the shooting occurs, there are two individuals on a bike? When Mr. Moore looks up, the second individual is gone. The gentleman with the hoodie is then firing down the street. Why wouldn't the logical inference be that the appellant was then shooting at the other person on the bike, that was an intentional act perpetrated towards that person?
There's several reasons why it's our position that wouldn't be an appropriate inference. One is because the trial court says that there's no evidence he's shooting at anyone. So that would be the strongest reason, because that's the trial court's finding of fact. Additional reasons are Mr. Moore testified that he looked down for about a minute, and what caused him to look up was seeing the gunshots, hearing the gunshots. And at that time, no one else was around, that person on the second bike was no longer there. No one saw someone fleeing from the scene. We have eyewitnesses at both ends. There's not someone running away. Also, Mr. Moore testified that the two gentlemen on bikes were talking prior to the second gentleman's departure, and there's no argument heard. It would seem that if they were talking, walking, getting along, that there would be something that went awry before that. It appears that that gentleman was gone before the shooting happened. So at some point during that minute that Mr. Moore looked down, he has, for whatever reason, departed. The evidence seems to specifically contradict that he was still there because of the coverage on both sides. It would be one thing if the eyewitnesses that are 400 feet down the street saw someone leaving, saw someone riding by on a bike, but that wasn't the case here. And the two witnesses at the other end of the street, they were there for about 5 minutes was the testimony, and saw no one walking by in that time. So that would have covered more than the 1 minute that Mr. Moore had his head down. Also, I believe her name was Miss Redwood, got out of the car after the shooting incident and looked around and was yelling and saw no one around at that time. So the evidence itself has established that second person was no longer there.
Well, I mean, you're holding a woman to a pretty strict standard here who just saw her daughter shot in the eye and has little children in the car, and she's desperate to try to get help to be able to look around and make sure that no one else is there. I mean, she's, wouldn't you think she'd be pretty focused on her family, her daughter who's lying there motionless, and the children that are in the car, as opposed to being able to see who was on the street or not?
I would agree that, of course, she's going to be focused on her family. However, when the question comes down to, was there evidence at trial from which there's a reasonable inference that there was a second person present, it's not just Ms. Redwood. She's saying that she didn't see anyone before the incident as well. But also, Mr. Moore testifies that he got out of his car and looked down the street and didn't see anyone. If Mr. Moore, who was...
Wasn't his wife with him, too?
Yes, Your Honor. She was standing outside of his vehicle on the passenger side of the car, whereas it's my understanding he was in the driver's seat, got out of the driver's side, and he testifies he looked down the street. Given that he's located 20 to 25 feet behind the shooter, when he's looking down the street, his vantage point would be similar to that of the shooter.
Assuming that what you're indicating is true, why wouldn't we be able to infer, or the trial court be able to infer malice from shooting into a street where there are buildings that are potentially occupied?
Because the testimony was not that there was a shooting at an occupied dwelling. Also,
The shooting was, what the court described was essentially that it was just shooting down the street. It wasn't a shooting up in the air or shooting into the ground. And malice can be inferred from the use of a deadly weapon, can it?
It can be inferred from the use of a deadly weapon unless the evidence gives rise to a reasonable doubt. And it is our position that for malice to exist, there has to be a person that is known to be in harm's way. So it doesn't have to be a specific target, but there has to be knowledge.
So if I think this is one of the examples that the trial court gave. So if, in fact, you happen to be shooting where there's a building and you don't know it to be occupied, but you strike someone, is your indication that there's no malice that's present in that type of scenario?
It would be my position that that would probably be appropriately charged under 18.233, felony murder, which this was not. We're dealing with second-degree murder here. So the type of implied malice that's covered in felony murder would certainly be a different question, but that was not a question considered by this court because it's not what Mr. Watson Scott was charged with. Moving forward, the Commonwealth did have the burden of proving malice. That is a requisite element of murder. And after hearing all of the evidence, the Commonwealth's own evidence seems to suggest the conduct wasn't directed at anyone, and that is what the trial court found. The trial court said there's no evidence he was shooting at anyone. So that specific finding of fact.
But if you're shooting down the street at 2:45 in the afternoon in the city of Richmond, it's not like you're out in the middle of the country somewhere shooting, you know, before the crack of dawn, perhaps, or at dawn. You're shooting down a street in the middle of the city, and there's no testimony he was just shooting even up in the air. Not that that wouldn't have potentially killed somebody too, but if you're shooting down the street in the middle of a crowded city, why can't the court conclude, why couldn't a rational fact finder conclude that there's malice there?
Well, two reasons. One is there wasn't testimony that the area was crowded at the time. But the other component is there's no knowledge that a person was there. So certainly this is not acceptable conduct. But as far as how King defines involuntary manslaughter, we're talking about negligence so gross, wanton, and culpable as to show a reckless disregard of human life. Perhaps that would cover the conduct of shooting down a street. That's not safe behavior. That is certainly creating a hazard. However, the question isn't, is this safe? Does this create a hazard? Is this a bad decision? The question is there malice? And malice is an intentional or wrongful act against another. Moving on to the issue of transferred intent. There was no evidence from which it could have been inferred that the appellant knew the decedent. There was also no evidence from which it could be inferred that the decedent was an intended target. Because of this, we need doctrine of transferred intent in order for a malicious intent, if that existed, and it's certainly our position that didn't, to establish malice to reach second degree murder. Under the doctrine of transferred intent, that requisite intent must be held against another before that mens rea could be transferred to the ultimate victim in a case. This presents the same problem as I just discussed relating to malice, and that is that there's no evidence from which it could reasonably be inferred that this conduct was directed at anyone. And again, the court specifically stated otherwise. So without the decedent being an intended target or being known or any other reason to infer that the conduct was directed at her, and that certainly does not seem to be the case, we do need there to be a person that's directed towards before that intent could be transferred. So even if this court were to find that there was malice in a general sense, which it's our position there's not, there's still not the transferred intent to establish malice in this case.
But if the court were to find that the malice was intended towards the second person on the bike, I would assume that the transferred intent then is not really at issue anymore. Would that be fair?
If that was the case, however.
Now, I understand that your position is the contrary, that if, in fact, there is no intent, obviously there can't be transferred intent.
Right.
Okay.
Yes, Your Honor. I would like to reserve the remaining
Certainly.
Portion of my time for rebuttal. Thank
Certainly.
You.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Rachel Yates for the Commonwealth. In this case, Your Honor, we're asking the court to affirm the judgment of the court below, first and foremost because George Watson Scott used a deadly weapon 4 times in a city street at 2:45 in the afternoon in a residential area. For that reason alone, and this is the reason given by the trial court in this case, the use of a deadly weapon itself carries an inference of malice, and that's reasonable under the circumstances of this case. The argument today that the Commonwealth didn't prove a specific target that George Watson Scott had in mind when he began firing his weapon is a red herring, and that's because there is no such requirement. There are 2 possible factual scenarios in this case that could be possible. The first is that Watson Scott fired a gun at a specific person, missed, and unfortunately hit Diane Winston. Under that scenario, clearly transferred intent would apply. And Mr. Watson Scott would be culpable. Under the other theory, and this is what a lot of time was spent talking about in the trial court, under the second theory, it's that Mr. Watson Scott was simply wildly firing into a residential area in the city of Richmond in the afternoon. And even under that scenario, Mr. Watson Scott is equally culpable.
Well, I think trial counsel's position was that that would be something akin to manslaughter because it would be a reckless handling of the firearm that would have resulted in the death and not something necessarily that would support the intent that's required for secondary murder.
Yes, that was the defense argument.
I think that's
argument.
Sort of what counsel was circling around.
Yes, Your Honor, that's the defense argument. However, the Supreme Court of Virginia, in a variety of circumstances, has indicated that malice can be found if certain elements are met, and specifically implied malice. If the defendant acts in a reckless, wanton manner, such that we can show that the defendant acted without regard for the lives of innocent persons or the rights of others, that constitutes a depraved heart theory of murder. The court in Pierce versus Commonwealth, a case cited on brief, went into great detail about that sort of reckless, wanton conduct that shows this person didn't care. Wicked and depraved heart is the specific example used. And so for that reason, even if the defendant didn't have a specific target in mind when he began firing, that clearly shows, in the context of this case and all of the surrounding factors, that this person exhibited exactly the type of malice delineated by the court in Pierce.
But I think counsel's position is that there's not a specific target for that intent, because you would admit that the decedent in this case was not the intended victim.
Yes, Your Honor, that's not the common theory.
Right, and that if, in fact, there was no intent specifically aimed at a particular person, it then cannot stand that it's transferred.
Under a transferred intent theory, yes, the Commonwealth would have to prove that the defendant was firing at a specific person. It could be any specific person. It could be someone else in the neighborhood that he tried to kill. And obviously, if that were the case, then there would be no argument here. But the Commonwealth is not required to prove a specific target under a depraved heart theory. And that's because malice is implied from the wanton actions of the defendant and showing that he doesn't care about the rights of others. For instance, in the Pierce case, which was a spring gun case, the defendant was a shop owner, had been broken into multiple times. In that particular case, he'd rigged a spring gun, and it wasn't directed at any particular person. He had no specific malice or ill will towards any one person, but his actions and the fact that he didn't label the spring gun or put any warning on the outside of this store showed that he had a reckless, wanton disregard for the rights of others and other human lives.
But is there any sort of distinction that can be drawn from somebody who loads a spring gun where there's a door where it's foreseeable that someone's going to open it versus, according to what appellant's saying, shooting into an area where there don't appear to be people on the street?
There's no distinction in this case, and I'll explain why. Defense argues that there's not specific evidence that the defendant knew other people were there, but when the facts are viewed in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth, the record does not support that assertion. In this particular case, there were multiple people who could see the defendant, and again, this is 2:45 p.m. on city streets. If I can see you, you can see me, and that's a reasonable inference the trial court could have drawn. The two specific eyewitnesses who testified who were at the car, Kenneth Moore and his wife, if they could see the shooter, it's a reasonable inference that the shooter was also aware that they were present. The testimony at trial is that the defendant and the other individual on the bike were walking up towards Hill Street on St. James Street. That's going past where those individuals were. I think it's a reasonable inference that the court could infer that if they can see the defendant, the defendant can see them. And that's not the only people present. We know multiple other people are present. There is testimony at trial that this is in a neighborhood, that this was in the projects. This is in a public housing development in the city of Richmond. There was testimony there are apartments on the corner of Hill and St. James Street, exactly where this happened. There was testimony that there was a nursing home located at the same T intersection. This is a crowded residential area. While there's not testimony specifically of who precisely was occupying these buildings, there is certainly enough evidence to show that a reasonable person would understand that when you fire a weapon, a deadly weapon, four times in a city street, that that is what is going to happen.
Counsel's indicated that that would fall more under the felony homicide. Do you want to speak to that as opposed to under 18232?
There are certainly, in any given case, multiple charging decisions available to the Commonwealth, but in this case, there is sufficient evidence to support a secondary murder charge, and I can't fault the Commonwealth in this case for making that choice. Otherwise, Your Honor, I did make a waiver argument. I'm happy to rest on brief on that unless the court has specific questions. And if there's anything else, I would ask the court to affirm. I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Lawler, you have a little bit over, or a little bit under 3 minutes.
The government has spoken about the Pierce case, so I would like to address that. That case is highly distinguishable from here. The testimony in Pierce from the defendant himself discussed how he knew this was a dangerous setup. He actually had a latch to remind himself of the dangerous setup in case he were to forget, so he didn't open the door, inflicting the harm on himself. And there was evidence that This involved a store. There had been prior robberies, threats of robberies, and he had notified the police in it. And he knew the police were in the habit of checking that building nightly to make sure that the door had not been opened, to make sure that there weren't intruders there. So he had specific knowledge that a person could be in harm's way in that scenario. And that knowledge of a person who would be exposed to the harm and his knowledge that was harmful based on his own actions make this entirely different from here. The government has also spoken about the witnesses who saw the shooter and how it would be a reasonable inference that the shooter could also see them. That is fair. However, those people are located 20 to 25 feet behind him in the opposite direction of shooting. If they were in front of him, certainly this would be a different scenario, and my arguments would not be valid. But they were not in harm's way because they were in the opposite direction of which the firing occurred. There's also been discussion about there being buildings. This is a residential area, but there's two things that matter about that. One is the evidence he's shooting up the street, not at the buildings. And two, he's not charged with felony murder. As far as depraved heart, which was discussed in the sense that there doesn't have to be a particular target, and that is true. However, the case law regarding depraved heart involves the knowledge of a person being in harm's way. The, I think, most commonly referred to example is the hypothetical in Whiteford about throwing a piece of timber or an item off a building, knowing people are present in the street below. And it says that as part of the statement of law, knowing people are present. So it's not just the possibility that maybe people are present. There has to be knowledge.
Doesn't the case law, in addition to talking about the depraved heart, also talk about a reckless indifference to the lives of others?
Yes, the lives of others. So that still involves there being people present who there's an indifference to. And that's absolutely the essence of the
case. On a city street at 2:45 in the afternoon, children coming home from school around that time, people being in a nursing home nearby, cars up and down the street, that's not a reckless indifference to the lives of others.
If there was evidence that there were kids coming home from school, that there were kids on the street, if there was evidence that there were other people on the street, if there was evidence that it was apparent people were on the street, yes, that would be a reckless indifference. However, the evidence in this case negates that. There are people in a parked car who do not see anyone around for 5 minutes. This appears to be a non-active scene as far as human beings being present.
Thank you, Councilman.